The CBS Radio Workshop, originally scheduled at this time, will not be heard tonight. Instead, from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, we bring you an address by Adlai E. Stevenson.
Since the National Convention, when Adlai Stevenson was nominated for president, he has traveled 16,750 miles, crisscrossing the country, bringing the campaign issues to the people. And tonight, in a paid political broadcast presented by the Democratic National Committee, he speaks to the nation from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Now to introduce Governor Stevenson, here is Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt in Los Angeles.
My friends everywhere, as many of you may know, one of my greatest interests and concerns has been for the welfare of our young people. All of you listening tonight, I'm sure, share this concern, especially you mothers and fathers of school-age children. For while we cannot protect our children against the many uncertainties they will face, we can equip them with the knowledge and compassion that comes from education to help them make their way in life. These are the things that make up the promise of a better life for our children, the promise of a happier, more prosperous, and sturdier United States. I know of no one more alert to these basic needs of our children. I know of no one more dedicated to the task of fulfilling those needs to the extent that government can, than the man who is to speak to us tonight from the heart of the great Middle West, the Democratic candidate for President of the United States, Adlai E. Stevenson.
Good evening, my friends, and thank you very much, Mrs. Roosevelt, for your kind introduction. I'm speaking to you tonight from Milwaukee, the home of the Milwaukee Braves. But they're not playing here tonight. If they were, I might not be here in the studio myself. You were told 2 or 3 minutes ago that this is a paid political program. And I've been told that this means that by now a large number of you are turning the television knobs to something more exciting than a political speech. I'm going to ask you to wait just a minute. I'm a strong believer in the right not to listen. And when you make as many political speeches as I do, you soon become an authority on how very boring political speeches can be, and even to the fellow who has to make them. But what I want to talk about tonight lies very close to my heart, and I think also to your heart. I'm going to urge you, therefore, to give it perhaps a little of your time. If you are a boy or a girl in grade school or a teenager, or if you're in college now, then my subject this evening is you. And if you are a mother or the father of a child in school or a youngster heading that way, then I think you will agree with me that the matter of education in America today and tomorrow is about as important a question as there is. I guess for myself, with 3 boys of my own, all in school and getting along, I count the importance of education second only to peace on earth. Of course, it won't help to educate them if there isn't a tomorrow for them to enjoy, and I hope to improve. School started again this month. And in hundreds and thousands of communities, this opening of school brings new realization that things on this front just aren't right, that they just aren't as they ought to be. For some of you, the problem is that your child can only go to school half a day because the schools in your town are so overcrowded. Or perhaps you have a child in a classroom that has 35 or 40 pupils in it. You know this means that if your child doesn't catch on to his reading lesson on the very first go-around, well, it's going to be just too bad. The teacher just isn't going to have much time to give him special attention. We're short in America classrooms for 5 million children. Or maybe your child has a teacher who is on an emergency certificate. This means, in plain words, that she isn't fully trained and qualified as a teacher according to the minimum standards of your state. In 90,000 schoolrooms in America, the class was called to order this morning by emergency teachers. Or even if she is a fully qualified teacher, you're probably also aware that she is shamefully underpaid. She's probably doing babysitting or other jobs nights and weekends to make ends meet. The average earnings of teachers in America's schools is today 10% less than the average earnings of workers in America's factories. Or perhaps you are more concerned about the overall quality of the education your child is getting. Its quality. You are wondering if he is learning the skills of mind and of hand that he's going to need to live in this world that is so much more complicated than the one that you and I grew up in. And whether he's getting enough of what a good teacher can tell him of democracy's meaning and of how to tell what is good from what is bad or just mediocre, and of the difference between truth and untruth. This all adds up to a crisis for our schools that presents, in my judgment, a very great danger to our country. First, but only because it is most obvious, we are terribly short of classrooms. The figures show that with the tremendous increase in the number of school-aged children, and even with an all-out local school-building effort in thousands of local communities, we are losing ground. We are falling behind at the rate of 50,000 classrooms a year. And I should warn you that just 5 years from now, there will be 13 children in our elementary schools for every 10 there now. Second, although the school building shortage is bad enough, the teacher shortage is far worse. Schools are not really made of stone and wood, if we stop to think about it. Schools are made of teaching. Wherever the great teacher Socrates was, there was a school. In the open streets of Athens, at a dinner table, or even in prison facing death, Jesus, speaking parables, made a school of the barren shore of a lake. It's teaching, far more than a school building, that determines the quality of the education that our young people get. And the worst of it is that we can't see what's happening to the teaching in our schools. We do know, however, that just in numbers, we're hundreds of thousands of trained teachers short, and that this situation is getting worse as the shortage increases at the rate of 50,000 unavailable teachers each year. Here is the most staggering fact, it seems to me, of all. If we want college-trained teachers for our children, one half of all of our college graduates during the next 10 years will have to go into teaching. Well, you know that they won't do it. And the classes will get bigger and the teaching standards will get lower. Now, the third problem is that a lot of young men and women who want and who deserve a college education, who are qualified for advanced education, they can't get it. 100,000, I'm told, of our ablest high school students today stop their education short, primarily, of course, for economic reasons. I can't be indifferent, nor can you, to the fact that this crisis in education has arisen in this age of abundance, in this richest of all nations in the history of mankind. I think it does us a grave injustice, and I think we are awakening now to a full realization of what we have been doing to the future of America. It isn't just the figures that I've mentioned that shock us. What does drive this failure of ours home is its now all too familiar symbols that you've heard. The roaring cutout of the hot rod car. Teenagers' beer cans strewn along the roadside. Jukebox blues dishing up love and religion in identical groaning tones. The rural mailbox ripped off just for laughs. A switchblade in the hand of a city teenage gang boy. Most of our children, who are sound and sensible, thank heavens, can take all this and leave it alone. But among us is a minority, and this minority has grown bigger in recent years. There is emerging a ugly, frightening spirit of cynicism, of arrogance, a wanton destructiveness, a toying with violence. And underlying all of this, a sense of disrespect for the standards of the past, a carelessness about the future. Another measure, it seems to me, of this failure is emerging in the now familiar statistics which demonstrate that our schools and colleges are not meeting the growing demand of our country for more specialists, more young men and women who are trained to do the important jobs of our society, to be scientists, engineers, doctors, social scientists, technical experts, and above all, to be teachers. It's taken a divided and competitive world to bring these shortages home. We're worried when we hear that Russia, the Soviet Union, is producing two engineers for each one that we turn out. But even if the Soviet Union disappeared from the face of the earth in a clap of thunder, even if the Cold Wars, the Hot Wars, were all suddenly to become a thing of the past, we would still have the problem of developing enough talents to man the posts, the guard posts of the new America, and to help us build the world and make it a better place to live in. How can they be? How can the wealthiest nation on earth, which for a decade has been boasting about its ever-expanding economy, how can it fail to keep producing that most humble but most important of things? I'll call it yeast for its bread. The biggest material problem we have, of course, is money. Money to build schools and to pay teachers a salary that will attract the teaching force that we have to have. We're spending about $10 billion a year now on education. What is that? That's 2.5% of our national income. The costs of doing the job we need to do will be much higher still. We have wanted and we have tried to meet our educational needs at the local level. And we are going to insist that the control of education stay in our local communities, particularly in those county and city and village school boards. This is the crowning feature, in a way, of our democracy at work, that the citizens of a town should determine what their children should be given, should be taught in their own town schools. Here, surely, is the way of doing things, is the seat and safeguard of our individual liberties. The central power has no control over our separate minds. But two great changes now make it plain that we are going to have to draw on federal tax funds for part of the money to pay our educational bill, which is increasing, as I say, so rapidly. One change is the fantastic expansion of our schools. In early days, our schools were for the privileged few. Today, they are truly for all of us. And this autumn, we have enrolled 41 million children And the other change is a great shift in our means of gathering taxes. This shift has resulted in the serious inadequacy of the property tax. And that is the tax from which we have traditionally financed our schools. It is about the only source of our local revenue. In relationship to the national product, the property tax yields only one quarter as much as it did 25 years ago. One quarter. This means that we really have no longer any choice except to use federal funds to bolster up our educational program. In fact, this has now been agreed upon, at least in principle. Now, what are we doing to meet this problem? While we were falling behind at an alarming rate on school building and on the recruitment of teachers, the president first proposed an elaborate scheme that might have been of aid to bankers, but not to our schools. Next, when the White House conference on education was finally held, and of course gave the idea of federal aid to education a firm mandate, the president, now 3 years after his inauguration, finally proposed another bill that seemed to me sound in principle but inadequate. But when a similar proposal introduced by Democratic Congressman Kelly came up for a vote in the House, a large majority of Republicans voted against it, while the majority of Democrats voted for it. It must be said, in fairness, and leaning far over backward, in fact, that the situation on that vote was complicated by other factors which crossed party lines. But I say, I am sure, in equal fairness, that with strong leadership from the White House, many Republicans would have supported that bill. As it was, in the midst of the debate this spring, a Republican congressman read a letter from President Eisenhower, which was hardly helpful, in which he said that unless we are careful, even the great and necessary educational processes in our country will become yet another vehicle by which the believers in paternalism, if not outright socialism, will gain still additional power for our central government. Now, I don't know whether this letter actually reflects the president's views on this very vital matter, but I wouldn't expect much leadership on behalf of our schools from anyone who does not entertain who entertains such philosophical misgivings about federal aid. To sum up, we have had during these 4 years fine words, lofty conferences, and high-sounding proposals about education. We have had no action, however, and no results. Now, what of the future? Because there are so many facets to this problem, and because their full discussion could take a good deal more time than I have tonight, I am preparing, and I shall issue within the next few days, a written statement outlining the course it seems to me that we should follow. But I want to indicate briefly how it seems to me we should help our local governments do what we all want to do for our children and for our country's future, too. I say first that we need a national educational policy, and we need it just as urgently as we need a coherent foreign policy and defense policy. The goal of this educational policy must be nothing less than the achievement of the fullest possible development of each individual's capacities and talents. It should aim not just at getting more children into more classrooms for more years, but also at making each child's education a richer, a more challenging experience than it has ever been before. Second, we have reached, indeed we have passed, the time for action in the commitment of federal funds to aid the states in their educational programs, as I have said. Now, this federal aid program must include aid for school construction. The bill which was before the Congress this year should go far toward meeting this need. But the federal aid program must also, in my judgment, be broadened to help meet the hidden crisis in education today. And that, as I've indicated, is the teacher shortage. Perhaps we should leave to each individual state the determination of whether its share of any such federal funds should be used to increase teacher salaries or to build new buildings. We will have to face and resolve the questions of whether these federal funds should be granted outright or on a matching basis also, and whether they should be distributed on the basis of the number of school-age children in each state or on the basis of need of the state or both. I want to mention here, regarding these details, only that it seems to me imperative that we insure against federal funds being used to reduce or supplant state or local support for education. That must not be. And that we insure also against these grants ever being a means of transferring to the central government any degree of control over the content of the educational process. And third, I think we should investigate thoroughly and adopt, unless serious difficulties are disclosed, a national program of college loans or of scholarships. Such a program could be devised to meet two acute problems. One, as I say, is the unfairness, the waste, as I see it, of any competent, ambitious young Americans being denied, for economic reasons, the college education that most boys and girls in this fortunate country are now able to get. I don't think that 100,000 boys and girls who want to go on with their schooling, who have the stuff to use it, should be denied that chance. Such a loan or scholarship program could also, particularly in connection with grants or loans for graduate work, be used to attract able young men and women into the fields of expert and professional training, like teaching and science and engineering, where we are today so dangerously short of manpower. And here again, these are obvious problems of detail. Whether these grants should be in the form of loans or scholarships, how the individual's economic needs should be measured, and so forth. Perhaps the handling of such a program should be turned over to an independent organization outside the government, as was done with the eminently successful Fulbright Scholarship Program. Now, I don't think that these details present any insuperable difficulties. Through these programs of federal aid to the states and federal scholarships or loans to qualified young men and women, I think we could go a long way toward giving our children a chance to realize their talents and fulfill their greatest promise. I realize that programs such as these that I have suggested don't come free, or even don't come cheap. Experience as governor of one of our largest states has given me a healthy respect for the price tag on any program of this kind. But I would say this. First, the costs of these programs are not nearly so large as their opponents will try to pretend. Second, I think that every dollar invested in a child's education will be repaid. Will be repaid with interest in his increased productivity as a member of the American society and economy. And third, I think the American people hold nothing, nothing superior to the future of their children. And I'm completely convinced that the nation which can afford the best automobiles, the brightest television sets, the biggest aircraft carriers in the world can also afford the best schools. Indeed, we can't afford to be penny wise and people foolish. One of you wrote me the other day that if our government can afford to pour millions of dollars worth of concrete for airport runways in North Africa, knowing that these runways will be obsolete within a few years, then I say our government can invest a lot more than it does now in the most critical asset, the young people of America. Money isn't the limiting factor only here, nor do I think that there is any lack of national will about this. I think that what it requires is a leadership that is humane, imaginative, determined, which cares about our children and the kind of world that they will build. A leadership that is obsessed with the idea that all human achievement begins with children and ends with people. Having said all this, I hardly need add that it is for me a basic assumption of any program for the better education of our children that we mean they should all be treated as completely equal, regardless of race or color or economic condition. And now this final word, if I may. I have said this is a task for leadership. But leadership in a democracy can be no more than the capturing of a people's will and the channeling of a people's power to realize their own best ideals. I believe so strongly in what I have said here tonight that it makes me uncomfortable that there is nothing any one man can do about it alone. And so I appeal to you for your help if you think that these things about them as I do. I appeal especially to you mothers. I choose this night to discuss this subject frankly because this is Democratic Women's Day. I salute you who are the heart of the party I speak for. Woodrow Wilson said many years ago, without your counsel, we should be only half wise. You are always active in politics for a constructive purpose. You see so clearly that government has a direct bearing on our homes, the future of our families, in fact, our whole lives. But my appeal tonight, I hope, goes beyond any partisan line. And if this business of our children's training does perhaps bear in more sharply on the consciousness of America's women than its men, I want, nevertheless, to issue tonight's challenge to all of us as Americans. It's a marvelous thing to be an American. And it isn't just a lucky break. It's an unresolved responsibility. A responsibility to make this country a sounding board for new ideas, a welcomer of everything free and hopeful, a generous nation, the eternal home of liberty, and the temple of truth.
Governor Stevenson's words leave me with a sense of urgency that something must be done and done quickly. I'm sure that thousands of you in your homes share this feeling with me and want to help. I know that you want to know how you can join me in this great campaign to elect Adlai Stevenson President of the United States. There is much work waiting for your willing hands, but nothing is more important than having your help in our drive to collect the money that is necessary to pay for such broadcasts as we have just heard. In order to make the most effective use of your help, we have set aside one day, Tuesday, October 16th, as Dollars for Democrats Day. On that day, throughout the country, we want you to help us in a door-to-door campaign to collect small contributions that will combine to pay for the radio and television time necessary to carry Governor Stevenson's voice to the nation. We need volunteers, thousands of volunteers, to help us in this collection campaign. Please call the Stevenson Keepover Committee in your community or telephone your local Democratic Party committee and tell them that you want to work on Dollars for Democrats Day. Remember, that day is Tuesday, October 16th, except in New York State, where it will be observed on October 5th and 6th.
Governor Stevenson spoke to you tonight from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. The announcer for the preceding broadcast, paid for by the Democratic National Committee, was Tom O'Brien. The CBS Radio Workshop, usually presented at this time, will be heard again next week on most of these same stations. This is the CBS Radio Network.